I was given a diary. We've certainly got some great material.
My name is James, and my dad has kept a diary each day since 1987.
Welcome back again to another Half-Life of Brian podcast. My name is James Carlberg, and I'm here with one half of my creators and the inspiration behind the podcast itself, Brian Carlberg. How are you doing, Dad?
I'm very well, thank you, son. Looking forward to looking through what happened in 1995.
Well, we're back, aren't we, after considerable technical issues. I mean, we're separate again. I'm in Cambridge, you're in Atherston. And I found out, Dad, that you're a bit of a diva when it comes to the technology. You have to have it just so, otherwise, it's no dice. You know, you take the ball and you go home.
Well, I like it. I don't know how it works, but I like to have it functioning. Not very good at fixing it.
But this is what you get when you give someone an eponymous podcast, folks. This is what happens. Yeah. It goes to their head. as you said, quite rightly, I'm digressing and you're keeping up track. We're talking about 1995.
Yeah.
So we're going through that. We're going through the latter end of the first season of your diaries, the first decade. Yeah. So we're pushing through to 1997 and we've arrived at not the penultimate, but we're getting there. And we're going to talk 1995. And it's off to an interesting start, isn't it, Dad?
Yeah, well, I've got the diary here opened. And first Sunday was the 1st of January, 1995. Apparently, I had a long lie-in. So I don't know what we've been doing the night before. But we're bringing the new year in, I suppose. Didn't get to bed till late. It was a very frosty morning, it says here in the diary. Cold, long lie-in, frosty morning. And I woke up to the news that Fred West had killed himself in his prison cell. That was the very first event of 1995.
And thought 2020 was bad.
Yeah. so it was a goodbye to him. And also, a friend and colleague passed away, Sid Stonehouse, who was the resident plumbing contractor at 3M at the time. He was always there, always available was Sid. I think he was way past retirement age, but he just couldn't pack it in. He was always in his van, turning up at the gate at 3M. Every time we had a leak or a plumbing job that we couldn't handle, he was there, him and his son, Dave. So he was our Super Mario, was Sid Stonehouse.
Atherston's Bob Hoskins.
Well, Polesworth's Bob Hoskins. And very sad. Sid, he once brought me a new wash basin round Arden Street when I smashed our existing one as I was trying to take a tap off or put one on. I got the Stilson was too tight and smashed straight through the china. He got us an emergency one free of charge, did Sid. So he was a good egg. It says here as well, Russians are still attacking Grozny, the capital of Chechnya. So that was an interesting geopolitical entry there. As we in previous podcasts, we'd seen the breakup of the Soviet Union, hadn't we? And how a lot of the satellite countries had become independent. And this was just one of the latest problems that the Russians had had. They'd had Chechnya, which was a lot of rebels there who were trying to break away from Russia itself. And I don't think Russia were having any of it because, it was on the border of the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And it was quite a strategic part of their map, and they weren't going to give it up. So
I think for the Chechen side of things, I mean, I was very young at this point, but it's been a big theme of the 90s is this kind of this hangover from the Soviet Union, and with certain nations getting free of the kind of the overseer of Russia on its borders. But for the reasons you say, very important geopolitical reasons, Chechnya, and it has a strong Islamic identity, I think, as well.
They were absolutely very, very ferocious fighters. These rebels, they were ruthless, absolute head cases. Actually, they had some pretty horrendous atrocities to their name. They had the they would go on to take over a school, Beslan, I think it was, and they. There was a lot of children killed there, I think.
So this is 10 years later.
Yeah, yeah. But so it was a long, protracted conflict. But, I mean, this is obviously detailed on the 2nd of January, 95. But they were pretty ruthless. But also, of course, you've got the Russian response was very heavy-handed as well. And it was a pretty horrible conflict, actually. I remember there was a theatre siege as well at some stage, where the rebels took over a theatre, and the heavy, typical sort of heavy-handedness, the Russians sort of went in with gas, and they gassed all the innocent people as well as the rebels. So
again, this was into the 2000s,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's interesting you should say that, because when you look at the Wikipedia entry for the Battle of Grozny, which spanned 94 and 95, it cites it as a Pyrrhic Russian victory, which if you know your ancient history, Pyrrhus won at the cost of the majority of his army. So it gives you a bit of an idea of the intensity of the conflict and the fighting, to the sense that the Russian army's casualties were incredibly high in part of the initial assault on Grozny. And I think it took some kind of change in tactics for them to win out.
So
a Pyrrhic Russian victory.
As I say, a pretty horrible conflict and brutality on both sides. And I think it's settled down now only because Putin's got a real strong man in charge there at the moment who's a dictator himself, in all senses of the word, and stands absolutely no nonsense whatsoever in anything out of order, and it's stamped on ruthlessly by his man in charge at the moment.
So I think our first mention of our good friend Vlad.
I think
we'll keep an eye on him going forward, because he's up to all sorts, to say the least.
Oh, definitely. I was back to work on the night shift that day, on the first shift of the new year, and I wasn't staying on shifts for too much longer, because apart from doing the OU, I was on my latest OU course then was OU M205, a 60-point one credit course for the OU, and I successfully negotiated that year. It was about design. It covered all aspects of design. And that was to start later in January. It went from engineering design, building design, clothing, every aspect of the design. It was very interesting.
The new range from Brian Carlberg.
Yeah, no, I didn't go into that. I did design a washing machine, which was very advanced. It was to kill all vibration. It instead of having a drum, it had a sphere, this washing machine, and it was like a sort of gyroscopic effect. It could roll and turn in three dimensions rather than the two dimensions of a normal drum, you know. And but I mean, it was so elaborate, there's so much mechanics to it, that the actual housing for the gyroscopic part rendered the drum so small at the center of the machine that you could probably only get a pair of underpants and socks in it. Or if you wanted it to be a decent family load size, then the actual machine would have to be the size of a small family car. So that's why you don't see many gyroscopic washing machines about. I don't think it really caught on my design. I passed the course. That was the main thing.
Back to the drawing board.
Yeah, back to the drawing board. Shortly to apply for another job then as well, and as a field engineer with 3M. So you were sort of overseeing a lot of the projects that they had for capital investment in the plant, which was a busy job, and it entailed lots and lots of hours, which kept me away from the family and that quite a lot. So it was a bit of a hard job that was to commit to. So what we got here, we had Larry Grayson pass away just a week later on Friday the 6th, and the same day as me satellite decoder packed up again. So I had to borrow one. We used to have decoders, which had a sort of credit card that you pushed in the front, which was your pass, and you could borrow them off each other and put them in your own decoder to get the TV on with Sky. But
you seem to have brushed over Larry Grayson in favour of the Skybox.
I read the entry the entry that said Larry Grayson dies and sat like Dakota packed up again. But yeah, Larry Grayson. Larry Grayson was the camp comedian who presented the Generation Game after and was it the Generation Game? I think he did after Bruce Forsyth packed in. He was born just a couple of miles up the road from where I am now, actually, in Chapel End in Nuneaton, and lived there all his life. And this sounds as if I'm making it up, this next bit, but it's very true. He had a lot of characters, Larry Grayson did, which were steeped in innuendo. He'd got a friend called Everard, and he had popping in Pete the Postman. and he had a friend called Slack Alice. Well, this house that I live in now, if you look at the deeds, and when it was first built in 1965, the very first owner and resident of this house was one Alice Slack. and I'm sure, because it's only a couple of miles away, that Alice Slack was probably somebody who Larry Grayson knew. So that's a claim to fame for our house. We ought to have a blue plaque outside, I think.
Well, if it's just for yourself, Dad.
Yeah, Slack Alice lived here. Where did you apply to get one? I think I'll put in for one.
Podcaster, yeah. Diarist.
Yeah.
You know, if Samuel Pepys can have one, then so can you.
Oh, yeah, for yourself, you mean. All right. Yeah. Well, I was thinking about Alice, Alice Slack. Oh, Slack Alice. Anyway, 3 days later, sadly, Peter Cook died. So there was a legend of the alternative comedy scene at the time, Peter Cook. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore were the pair, but Peter Cook was from Beyond the Fringe and one of the Oxbridge early alternative comedians, if you like, who was quite controversial and very, very clever guy he was, Peter Cook.
Why did they have such cut through, really? I mean, you've got a very certain brand of comedy going on at the time, which I guess is like the 70s, right?
60s was all his prime stuff.
Why are Pete and Dud so revered as pioneers of comedy?
Well, they were very anarchic at the time, and they pushed the envelope, if you like, on politics. And Peter Cook was pretty scathing towards politicians with his sarcastic wit, you know, very rude as well. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, with innuendo as well, when they spoke, and with the two monologues, like with their raincoats on and the flat caps and the pints in front of them, he'd be really good at making Dudley Moore corpse. Peter Cook, I remember, where he'd ad lib things and Dudley Moore would try and control his laughter, but he couldn't, you know, he'd lose it, and Peter Cook would sort of be ruthless and really make it worse. And it was really funny to watch, that was.
I think that's something that's carried over, isn't it? You see, get Vic and Bob these days.
That's the sort of thing, that kind of
heritage of breaking with the script, breaking the program a little bit.
Anyway, that sort of anarchic sort of humor, which was carried on with like by the Pythons and the 9 o'clock news, people like that. They're the same sort of stuff, sort of clever comedy.
And the Derek and Clive tapes.
Derek and Clive was them at the very most anarchic, when they'd get out of their skulls on booze, I think, and then they'd just ad lib into the microphone the most outrageous stuff. How it ever got past the censors, I'll never know. But, Derek and Clive were their alter egos. They're really bad alter egos with some extremely obscene stuff that they put out.
Imagine
if they had
a podcast.
Yes. Oh, yeah. God, there's a havoc with that. Anyway, Peter Cook, comedy legend. He died early in January. The very next day, after the Peter Cook entry, we got Andy Cole gone to Man United for $7 million. I think it was $6 million plus Keith Gillespie coming the other way as well to Newcastle. Flying Northern Ireland winger he was. He was one of the great prospects for Man United, along with Beckham and Scholes and Button, all those lads, the Nevilles, and managed to get him in exchange with the money. So Andy Cole had been banging the goals in for Newcastle. He was absolutely prolific, and we were very sorry to see him go. But we trusted Kevin Keegan. He was building a team, you know, and he'd got plans. We finished sixth that year, actually, in 95. And actually, Blackburn won the league. Blackburn won the league in May. We finished sixth, qualified for Europe. UEFA Cup it would have been then, wouldn't it?
And of course, that's the year Alan Shearer won his Premier League title.
Yes, with Blackburn, yeah, yeah. I mean, he was to join us later on. And yeah, it was a good season, that was. And staying with Newcastle, now that we've mentioned him, with the Andy Cole entry, we had a fantastic time in the close season, just before the new season started. We bought David Ginola and Les Ferdinand. So that was a sign of ambition, even though Andy Cole had gone. In the pre-season friendlies, Newcastle played Rushton and Diamonds, who were just an amateur side near Northampton, that is, I think. Rushton, isn't it? Is it about halfway between you and I now, James, I think, isn't it?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we decided to go. We thought, well, go and see this friendly.
Seems a bit unfair playing two teams, Rushton and Diamonds.
Yeah, Rushton and Diamonds. They were actually, I think they've, I don't know what happened to them, because at the time, in 1995, they'd just been taken over by the fella who owned the Dr. Martin's boots company. And he was a very rich guy. He piled loads of money into them. He built a fabulous ground. Rushton and Diamonds ground was unbelievable. We turned up early to see the game. There was nobody there. We'd got there early, and this fella who was like the groundsman come doorman said, "Oh, you come to see the match, have you?" I said, "Yeah, later on." And he says, "Would you like to have a look round?" And this fella took us in to the reception. Well, you couldn't believe it. The reception at Rushton and Diamonds, they got this like marble floor, and they got this crystal chandelier going up to the very top of the stand down to the reception, and they got a lift. The lift took you up to the second floor at the top of the stand, and they got like a curved staircase that you could go up if you wanted to, which led into these huge lounges that had huge glass windows overlooking the pitch. And the BBC were there at the time with there's a huge snooker table in this one lounge with a really long bar. And they got the camera set up there was a national snooker tournament going to be played there with all the top stars and everything. And it was like the Crucible in Sheffield. I couldn't believe it. This ground was out of this world, because this fellow threw all this money at it, you know. It was very impressive.
I remember I was only about nine at the time.
Yeah.
So I remember it being like the staircase on the Titanic. It was,
it
seemed to be this unreal. I can't quite remember how we ended up being taken around this point. But here we were.
Yeah.
And of course, that wasn't the end of the story.
Well, no, because anyway, the match was good. The Newcastle won 3-1, as to be expected. You know, a top Premier side against
two teams.
Rushton and Diamonds, who were... yeah, the one... I think there were two teams that merged. It was Rushton, and I think there were Earthlingborough Diamonds, I think they were called, when they merged together to form one. And they didn't have a huge crowd or anything. I don't know what's happened to them since. It'd be interesting to find out, actually. But we won 3-1. Les Ferdinand scored two. And a lad called Brayson scored the other from the youth team. He was just a little fella. And I thought, well, he looked really good, I remember, in this game. And I thought, he's destined for big things. So I don't know what became of him. He didn't... nailed down a place in the first team, sadly. But Ginola played, and Howie and Warren Barton, and all the Ferdinand, Beardsley, of course, you know, a real good side. And afterwards, we went into the bar to have a drink, and within 20 minutes or so, all the Newcastle squad all came in. Terry McDermott and everybody but Kevin Keegan. He was the only one missing. Oh, it was brilliant. They were with us, and we mingled with all the players, and had loads. They were happy to have photographs taken. Warren Barton held your brother Alan in his arms, like, and was happy to pose with him for a picture. And Auntie Sheila was having cheek to cheek cuddles with David Ginola and
his arse cheeks, probably.
Yeah. And Peter Beardsley and Steve Howie and all the stars were all there. They were quite happy to chat and have pictures taken. It was magic. And this diary that we're referring to, it's full of the autographs, because I had it with me, and I've got all the team's squads autographs here. It's It's absolutely magic. It was one of the best days we've ever had, that was. And of course, and that team was to go on to, by the end of 95, they were top of the Premiership and leading into the next year, you know. Sadly, we got pipped in the end by Manchester United. But
That's probably going to be a controversial 96 podcast.
Yeah, next year. We'll talk about that in the next podcast. But 95, we blazed the trail to the top of the Premier League anyway, with the team that we'd all been chatting and mingling with. I remember Auntie Sheila grabbing hold of David Ginola for a selfie. They weren't called selfies then. We didn't have camera phones or anything. But I remember him saying, "Okay, you can have a photo, but be quick," he said, I think, to her.
I didn't know he was from Trinidad. I was like, he's French. Oh,
that was my South of France best accent. So we jumped a bit there. We jumped a bit to the, because we mentioned Andy Cole. It made us roll all the Newcastle bit into one, really. But we were back in January when Andy Cole was sold. Around that time as well, we had...
I mean, you got the evils of Man United being mentioned.
Yeah, we had in January, we had Eric Cantona was up to his tricks when he kung fu kicked a fan at Crystal Palace in one game. And then he ended up getting himself banned for that for the rest of the season, because it's not done. Players can't attack fans. The truth is that the fan was being very obnoxious and abusive towards him, but still they can't do that. He was rightly banned then for the rest of the year. But after that, he was made Player of the Year when they voted for the Premier League Player of the Year, which I didn't agree with, actually. I thought, well, you know, you can't vote somebody as Player of the Year who's got that on their record. But I didn't have any say in the matter.
So according to John Sulaco, he recalled, "I saw him confronting the crowd and then he just launched into this kung fu kick."
Yeah.
So I think that's where the famous quotation has come from, how it's kind of earned its name. John Sulaco coined that's what happened. And if you look at the GIFs, the imagery that's out there, it does look pretty damning.
Oh yeah, it was. It was horrendous. I mean, they were playing in their change kit of all black, I think Manchester United were, which fitted the bill of a villain launching into the crowd with a kung fu kick. Gas fire and boiler was condemned in our house, so I had to buy a new one from Poser for £500 for a gas fire and back boiler, and I decided to fit it myself, which I did, and it worked successfully, so I was quite pleased with that. That was a good bit of work done, and not very exciting for the podcast. But we had your brother Al had a couple of achievements. He got an entry where he's
from Cantona to Carlberg.
He disposed of his stabilizers on his bike and started to ride around the square with you without his stabilizers. Al can now ride his bike without stabilizers for the first time. That was March, actually, March the 12th. And I've got a day off. In the new job where I was working all the time, and I actually got a day off. And
I believe that's recently just happened this year with
Reece. Yes, with Isla. She's just cast hers off just recently, in recent weeks. So we've just got to work on little Charlie now to get to do the same with him. Alan also, I've got here in the diary, Alan was starting to go to karate at the Memorial Hall. So he, every Monday night, would take him to karate.
Cantona.
No. it wasn't just a coincidence. He was really enjoying it. So we've mentioned it in a previous podcast when I used to go. But he started to go in this year. And was doing okay, I think, until the actual club packed in through lack of members, which was a shame. We went. I don't know how to play this one, James. It's important, really. We went to on the 18th of April. We went a trip to Warwick Castle and had a really nice day at the castle, where you and, just a family day out and enjoyed the tour around and all that. And that's when you were poorly in the car on the way back. And
yeah, so this year I kind of found out that I'd had some form of seizure. And that was something that sort of plagued me a bit throughout my lifetime. I'm happy to say it doesn't happen now at all, but it's quite a harrowing experience at the time. Anyone who has seizures or epilepsy, I certainly have every sympathy for them. Because you know, people would have had it far worse than I have, and it will carry on into later life as well. So you know, it was a Warwick Castle, well worth a visit if you ever in the area. It's a fantastic, you know, originally a Norman castle, which has been developed on over the years into the 16th and 17th century, and is a real, you know, highlight of our area. But unfortunately that day it coincided with the unfortunate event of me having a seizure. But I'm pleased to say all's good now. That's all sorted out.
Well, you just passed out, really. You just passed out and went still. That was all. But we decided to get a mobile phone after that, because we hadn't had one. So a week later, we were off, got our very first mobile phone.
So what did that look like?
1995. Well, I've bought a mobile phone from Comet in Coventry, I've got here.
Well, that's gone.
25th of April. And do you know, I can't remember what it looked like. I think it was black. And it had just like obviously buttons. It was black. It had a few buttons. And it had a monochrome screen, which just had little black letters or numbers that would come up on the monochrome screen. You know?
I mean, this would be pre the rise of Apple, so you're probably talking about Nokia.
Yeah, it was something like that. Yeah, I can't quite remember now. I haven't gone into detail here. I've just bought a mobile phone from Comet. And then mum and dad had the car broken into last night, it says here, on the day after, Wednesday the 26th. We'd gone to Foss Park the day before looking for mobile phones and computers. I bought an AST PC from Byte in Shirley. Your credit card has reached critical mass, it said. Mushroom cloud over Shirley as my credit card exploded. we had a mobile phone after that,
because I guess these things would have cost a lot at the time, you know. You got even your basic mobile phone now essentially you have a mini computer in your hand, which can do pretty much anything you want if there's an app for it.
Nothing like that these things were.
And a computer would now, I'm talking to you, we're talking to each other through flat screen media. I remember our first computer, if it's the one I'm thinking of, it looked like some kind of boat.
they were deeper than what they were wide, weren't they? Huge great screens and big keyboards as well.
I mean, on that subject, we got talking pre-podcast about your OU course, because you're still doing this at the same time, weren't you? And we're talking about the progression of the floppy disk.
Yes. I got the wrong size floppy disk sent for this course, and there were 5 1/4 inch floppy disks, and they really were floppy. These 5 1/4. Why 5 1/4 inch? I'm sure it was because the metric size was probably 250 mil or something, and when you had to describe it in imperial measurements, it became 5 1/4. So 5 1/4 floppy disks were no good. I had to have 3 1/2 inch ones. And 3 1/2 inch ones were really impressive compared to the 5 1/4, because they called them floppy disks still, but they were actually solid plastic and they looked substantial. You know, they looked slick and good and useful. Of course, they're long gone now.
Floppy disks. Whopping 1 meg of data.
Yeah.
It reminds me. We bought a game called Rise of the Robots, which I'm sure if you're of a certain age, you might remember the age of the sort of the beat-em-up video game was its hype with Mortal Kombat and things being out. So you had a Mortal Kombat clone, and this thing took 12 floppy disks to install, which took about 7 hours to do.
I remember that.
For what was a pretty average video game in the end. But
And they'd freeze, wouldn't they? The screen would freeze sometimes.
90s technology, ladies and gentlemen.
It's funny that. The 19th of April, so just 5 days after my, would have been my 39th birthday, I think. Yeah, birthday, 39 today, on the 14th of April.
Life begins soon, Dad.
Yeah. So still in my 30s, like you. Went down there.
It's a bit of a David Brent line, that one.
Yeah, went down Mum and Dad's tonight to watch Everton 2, Newcastle 0 on Sky TV. Oh, that must have been a rare defeat then, because we had a good side. 5 days later, we'd been to twice across Zoom in the meantime, and I'd finished completing the fire and boiler installation, and we'd been to Warwick Castle, and then a couple of days after that, it was actually on the 19th of April, there was a huge bomb, I've got here in the diary, huge bomb in a building in Oklahoma City, USA. Now, this was a far-right sort of domestic terrorist who planted a massive bomb which killed 168 people and injured another 500, I think. I mean, this building had got a crash in it with children and office, you know, office staff. It was pretty dreadful.
I mean, I'm looking at the images now, Dad. So as you say, April the 19th, 1995, you've got this image. But if you...
That was a big multi-story thing, I remember.
If you look at my screen now, you'll see the devastation that was caused by this bomb, which took off literally half of this building and is absolutely dwarfed. You know, you've got these fire engines dwarfed beneath the building itself, and just the entire fascia is just blown away with what must have been scores of floors of people contained within them. So it took the lives of 168 people, including 19 children, at the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was led to the investigation, the conviction of what now is a very infamous name of Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah.
And his co-conspirators Terry Nichols and Michael Fortier. I mean, terrorism seems to be quite a big thing that happens and is talked about in everyday life now. Mm. Was this sort of thing commonplace in the 90s?
Well, they've always had this fringe of people, I think, and you see them now on these demonstrations and marches now in America, these people who are armed to the teeth, and they feel as though the government is their enemy, sort of almost against them to repress them. And it goes way back, I think, to the actual sort of frontier spirit of the first people in America who pushed west and staked their own claim to land, and they carried weapons to defend themselves and their animals, and it's a sort of hangover from that. I think they feel as though they shouldn't be told what to do, and the government is oppressing them, and they're usually sort of far right, highly well-armed people who were against authority. And
I mean, without getting too much into the kind of it's highly linked within the whole Second Amendment debate, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, the right to bear arms and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. So without forming too much of a position on that, I think the wording in that is the idea that you can bear arms against enemies of the US, both foreign and domestic.
And that's a good summary. That
a certain interpretation is that domestic means oppressive government.
Yeah, definitely.
And do you think this is that's the line of thinking that kind of led to the conspirators in this attack?
Oh, definitely, yes, I think so. Yeah. He was fitted that bill perfectly, you know. It was also something to do with the retaliation against the government's heavy-handedness against the ending the Waco siege, which we talked about in Texas, if you remember, in a previous podcast. They use that as a justification as well. But anyway, he got his punishment. He was because in America they had the death penalty, and Timothy Fay was executed.
So according to Special Agent Barry Black, who was a first-hand investigator on the Oklahoma City bombing case, he claims it introduced a frightening new concept for the United States: homegrown terrorism. So until the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the country had not witnessed an event of this size, let alone carried out by American citizens. So the claim is that the FBI massively shifted their priorities from looking at, I guess, foreign threats to putting more investment into the idea of, that idea of homegrown terrorism and trying to, inspired series such as Homeland and things like that, ultimately, I would think,
That's right.
I know that's based around the CIA, but, you're thinking about this idea now that the game's changed somewhat. And I think that this event in 1995, as horrific as it is, still has its legacy to this day in terms of law enforcement in America.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. shortly afterwards, you'd got on the 10th of May, which is just a couple of 3 weeks later, you'd got the Ebola virus was wreaking havoc in Africa, in Zaire in particular. So that was a particularly virulent and nasty virus, which caused people's organs to sort of disintegrate and bleed from within, and highly, highly contagious as well. We went actually in June, just after that, the 10th, exactly a month after that, Hollywood, not missing a trick, had brought the film Outbreak out, starring Dustin Hoffman. And we actually went to Tamworth to the cinema to see that. I can remember being petrified of viruses after that, after seeing it. Everyone was walking around in spacesuits in the film, you know, frightened to touch anybody else. And of course, that has connotations with what we're going through at the moment, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was a very cute but deadly monkey in that film. That's the kind of the conduit. Yeah, Ebola virus, you know, as you've said, it's pretty horrible. Mm. And it says EBD located mainly in sub-Saharan Africa. People can get this. This sounds familiar. People can get EBD through direct contact with an infected animal, bat, yeah, or non-human primate. So, you know, this kind of thing's going in cycles, clearly.
Yeah,
But yeah, I mean, what was so special? What was particularly notable about the case in Zaire? Was it just wreaking havoc?
Yeah, there were so many victims, so many people. It was so virulent, you know, so contagious that lots of people were catching it, and it manifested itself in such a horrible way as well. You know, it was a really, really unpleasant death, I think. Yeah. But it was interesting connection that, you know, Outbreak at the pictures, and here we are in a pandemic at the moment.
I mean, there was a recent, I remember in recent years, there was talk of it. There had some cases in this country, but I suppose being where we are, you know, as a developed country, the impact of these sorts of things can be lessened somewhat. And, you know, you would hope that would apply to what we're going through at the minute.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Stay safe, everybody.
The next thing we did, which was a bit of a bittersweet thing, we booked a hovercraft from Dover to Calais for the summer holiday, and we hired a motorhome, which is something we've done several times over the years. We decided we'd go and tour France with this motorhome, with the aim of going down to the south of France in the sunshine, and Grandma and Granddad, Charlie and Mary, decided they'd like to come with us. So we said, oh, by all means, you know, welcome them to come with us. And so we duly set off on the 6th of August, that was, the height of the summer. And we got an early hovercraft. We drove to Paris once we'd got the other side. And we actually stopped under the Eiffel Tower in this motorhome. You could get right up to it then and park under the arches of the Eiffel Tower. And,
I suppose given what we've recently talked about in this podcast, that's very unlikely now.
No, definitely not. the traffic's different now, I think, around there. But we stopped under the Eiffel Tower, and we went round, it says right here, we went round the Arc de Triomphe and down the border of Boulogne at a campsite in Paris. And then the next day we drove partly to Auxerre in Burgundy country. So we covered some ground there. I'm literally looking at the entries of the diary here. It says different places we stayed at. We stayed at Macon, I don't know if I pronounced that right. Looked round the riverside, coffees, then pressed on to Valence, Epervier campsite. Stayed a while at Orange, Bagatelle campsite, and then went to Avignon. Avignon, we've been there a few times. That's a beautiful place. A really nice municipal campsite as well there, with a beautiful swimming pool with diving boards and a high splashboard. I can remember being with Auntie Sheila on this top splashboard and being too timid to jump off it into the pool. And then this tiny little Tot came up behind us. It'd only been, you know, 4 or 5. Just never gave it a second thought. Just stepped straight off into the water. And I can remember Sheila saying, oh, I've got to do it now, haven't I? And stepping off the board. And as she did, after she stepped off, going, oh, Jesus. She was so terrified. But she'd been shamed into it by this tiny little tot pushing in front of us and doing it. We went to Provence, arrived in Aix-en-Provence, camped at the Chantelclerc campsite on a hillside. I remember that.
Apologies for any French listeners. We're clearly uttering the French language here. You've got a beautiful language here, but we're not so au fait with it.
Yeah. It's not Aix-en-Provence, is it? Aix-en-Provence. And that was really nice. I remember they had a pool there as well. That was nice. This is where it takes a bit of a downturn, the holiday, because Grandad wasn't feeling well. And the second thought, he should never have come with us, but he just wanted to be with us, I think. But sadly, he couldn't stick it. And when we got to the south, we were in Port Grimaud, which has always been one of our favourite places, at Prairie's campsite. We were there and playing in the sea, and we've been to Saint-Tropez. But then we set off towards the east, and we were making our way really to get to the airport, Marseille airport, because we had to get Grandma and Grandad onto a plane to get him home to be seen by a doctor. And to cut a long story short, it was the start of a diagnosis for Grandad's terminal illness, and he had to undergo chemotherapy and have a couple of operations for the next few months. And it was a signal of the impending end for him, you know. It wasn't happening for a while yet, though.
It's a bit of a time of contrast, really.
Yeah. We had a lovely time, but then we had that sort of bombshell news that he was going to have serious operations and treatment, you know. And we carried on, actually, after that, and went to the Camargue, and we saw the famous Camargue cowboys herding bulls in their festival, and I've never seen anything like it. They were all steaming drunk, these people, and they were sitting in chairs in the middle of the road, and then literally, and a bit like Pamplona in Spain, they were letting a herd of bulls out to charge down the street. The last one off the chair in front of this charging herd was the winner. That's if you could dodge the bulls.
hell of a drinking game.
Oh, yeah, it was incredible. It was fascinating to see. The cowboys of the Camargue. So anyway, we returned to Avignon then, and then we worked our way back up the Rhone Valley, eventually drove through the middle of Lyon, eventually worked our way back to Paris, and we ended up parking outside Euro Disney, and ended the day by going in, having a day in Euro Disney, and staying for the night on the huge car park next to Euro Disney, which was nice. And we drove from there back to Calais. We're way back home then from the hover port. So we actually had a little stop off in London as well. It says here, set off from Dover at 8:30 a.m. Arrived in London at 11 a.m. Parked at Tower Bridge, and went aboard HMS Belfast. I'll bet you can remember that.
I remember this vividly. You just took us on a giant warship, and we just ran round it like mad.
Yeah.
Pretended to fire cannon fire off onto Tower Bridge and the tower.
It was that.
I didn't realize it coincided with that particular holiday, but that's,
yeah, it did. That's, yeah.
What a summer.
On the way back, yeah. So we saw the Royal Yacht Britannia, that was moored nearby, and we watched preparations for the day's VJ Day parade. Victory Japan Day parade was about to be was making preparations for. We got home at 3 p.m. It says here, yeah, and it said your granddad seemed more comfortable at home, and we showed him the holiday video, and he enjoyed that.
So he didn't miss out entirely on seeing everything then?
No. He caught up with everything then.
And it was a big summer for other things going on. I mean, music this year is off the chain in terms of being in the height of British music scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, Oasis, they've produced some massive songs. So Some Might Say and Roll With It. One of the feel-good hits of the summer was Supergrass Is All Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But tragically, Robbie Williams has left to Take That.
Yes, yes. And they had their hit Back For Good, which is a big hit of theirs. And then Robbie left the band, yeah.
And I remember this being a big thing. This might not mean a lot to you, but the girls might as well be wearing black armbands at school the next day. I remember this quite vividly, actually. All the lads going, I don't know, we're just turning up playing football on the playground, and all the girls are sort of looking all forlorn and bereft. So it was quite a big deal, because he was the kind of the bad boy, the cool one to fancy in the group, you know.
Yes.
So yeah, it was a big deal that summer. Pulp are about with the anthemic Common People.
Yes, yes. Good stuff.
And also in movies, huge movies this year.
Yeah.
And the biggest one being Pixar hitting the scene with their huge debut, which is none other than Dad.
Toy Story.
Yeah, and you know what that means about the toy that Christmas.
Oh yes, everybody would want Buzz Lightyear, wouldn't they? Yeah.
So there's a bit of a tale to tell with this one as well, isn't there?
Yes, I can remember. That's right. I remember trying to get it. We got it. Actually, we got one. That's right. We got a Buzz Lightyear, and people wanted to buy it off us because they couldn't get them, and you were getting people offering you silly money, like you know, more than what you paid for it. Because there was a Buzz Lightyear shortage. I can't remember what we did.
I remember you tried to prize it away from Alan.
Yeah, I don't think we sold it on the black market. No. Alan wouldn't let us,
enough. He did, because he'd already written his name on the bottom of his foot and everything like that.
Yeah, that's right.
You were there going, I'll get you two. I'll get you two.
I was thinking, God, I brought out the capitalist in me there. I'm trying to make a killing on the Buzz Lightyear, but he was having none of it.
Yeah. But what a film that year, and no wonder created such a craze along with that. So that was kind of Pixar bursting onto the scene. Obviously, we had some very famous people leave us. I mean, we had the infamous Fred West. He won't be missed. And Sid Stonehouse, obviously locally, he was a top by the sounds of things, and local lad Larry Grayson. But beyond that, there were some really big names, both infamous and famous as well.
Yes, we had, along with Larry Grayson and Peter Cook, we lost Kenny Everett, the DJ and comedian, which was very sad, because he was always on TV and always entertaining. Was Kenny Everett? He was only 50. I think it was AIDS related, his death. Jerry Garcia, of the leader of the very aptly named Grateful Dead,
one of the best band names ever.
American blues rock band, and. Like I say, infamously, as well as Fred West, Ron Cray of the Cray Twins died in March. He was 61. Ronnie was. He was the scarier one of the two, I think. He was the one who was, you know, really, really unbalanced. Ronnie is a real scary fella, I think.
But they were for those who of our listeners who are less kind of Anglophiles and less UK focused. They've got a degree of infamy here, haven't they? The Cray Twins.
Oh yeah,
Most recently represented by Tom Hardy, of course, in the film Legend.
Legend.
But who were the Crays, and why are they? Why is the Ron Cray departing this year such a significant thing?
Well, as I say, they'd ruled the East End of London, hadn't they, with notorious gang called the Firm, running protection rackets, and they were. But who knows how many people had been killed, really? And but the police only sort of needed to pin evidence on one killing, really, on each of them to get them put away. Anyway, Ron was put away on the evidence that they'd got for him killing George Cornell in the Blind Beggar pub. George Cornell being a villain himself, like. A rather foolish one. He'd gone into the pub and to his face had called Ronnie Cray a fat puff, which wasn't very advised. not the sort of thing I would have gone to Ronnie Crane's set. So that that sealed his demise. Ron shot him dead. But there's a sort of notoriety and fame and a glamour that's been built up around them, which is really unfounded, because I think they were really nasty pieces of work who you know, never did any good, really. They dodged the draft and things like that when the country needed them and what have you. They weren't the sort of people who were looking to do good at all. They were bad to the bone, and it's a bit of a misnomer, this industry that's built up seeing how they were good. I don't think they were at all.
I mean, famously, I think part of it's they really integrated into that kind of celebrity culture quite well, didn't they?
Looking with
Diana Dawes and Barbara Windsor and people like that, and I suppose that, you know, having those sorts of friends in those circles to kind of wash your image a bit, kind of helps you get
a false impression of what they were like, really.
Yeah. So you
it doesn't wash with me.
It's like that romanticism of the '60s, and London in the '60s in particular.
Yeah.
Is seen as, in a, you know, because of Michael Caine and people like that, is seen as in a certain way, I think.
Yeah.
Ronnie Crane, of course, when he was and charged with that murder in March 1969, both the twins were sentenced to life imprisonment.
Yeah.
With a non-parole period of 30 years for the murders of Cornell and Jack Hat McVitie. Ronnie and Reggie Cray were in prison for a very long time.
Yeah.
After that, with Ronnie in particular, because of his issues, his mental issues, being at Broadmoor Hospital.
Yeah, which is for the criminally insane, isn't it? There's Broadmoor and there's Rampton is the other famous one. So he ended up in Broadmoor. It's far from glamorous. You know, anybody wants to take their lives as a lesson in not to do that sort of thing, because they spent the best part of their lives slopping out and being confined to behind bars, and having the only time they saw daylight was out in an exercise yard. So it's not a very glamorous way to live, is it?
And of course, if there's anyone from the Cray family listening, they were lovely lads. we can't say anything nicer about them.
No. Really.
But interesting, you inferred about Ronnie Crane. He was somewhat openly homosexual or bisexual, which obviously drew a lot of criticism from people who were his enemies. But it's quite interesting that was the open secret that was out there.
The one that George Cornell spoke about it too, which he shouldn't have done.
No, in hindsight.
Yeah.
Bad decision.
Yeah, bad move from George, that was. Well, there's a contrast. We're talking about Ronnie Crane, then you've got somebody like Harold Wilson, who's one of the few Labour prime ministers to actually be elected. You know, there's not that many of them, and Harold Wilson was certainly a prime example. And also, I've always admired him because he was the fellow who championed the Open University, of course. Is University of the Airwaves that he always wanted to get off the ground, and you know, it became a success, which I benefited from. And you're doing one yourself now, aren't you?
Yeah, doing a linguistics master's degree. In the modern age, I think looking at it now, I mean, you talked about the University of the Air.
Yeah.
That's kind of a concept that was kind of pre-internet, and this idea of distance learning.
Yeah.
It would necessitate radio shows and going things through TV and things like that.
TV programs and correspondence, you know, actually written down and posted backwards and forwards. That's what Harold was thinking of at the time.
which is an amazing ambition and feat in itself for that to work as a system. And like you say, you've benefited from it. More broad, obviously, that's one of the things that he can be praise for championing. What was his tenure like as a prime minister in general? Was he plagued by any particular issues, or did he face any particular challenges?
Well, he was always up against the right wing bias of the press that we've got in this country and that we've had you know, since the start of the last century, really. They're always up against it in that respect. He's from Huddersfield, I think, and he was, I don't know whether he was a university man himself or not. I'm not sure. Period of low unemployment and relative economic prosperity.
So in 1964-70, Labour government carried out a broad range of reforms during its time in office, such as social security, civil liberties, housing, health, education and workers' rights.
Huddersfield, born in Huddersfield.
Best remembered for the liberal social reforms introduced or supported by Home Secretary Roy Jenkins. Notable above these was the partial decriminalisation of male homosexuality and abortion, reform of divorce laws, the abolition of theatre censorship and capital punishment. Abolish capital punishment.
I've always admired him. Harold Wilson and his University of the Airwaves. Musically, you'd got... there's a few went musically, and in 1995, Viv Stanshall, lead singer of the Bonzos, 51, who died in March. And
sorry, that was just noise. What does the Bonzos mean?
The Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, which were a bit of a comedy music troupe. Viv Stanshall was the lead singer, very, very talented and funny guy who passed away. He was only 51. He lived on a houseboat on the Thames, and he set it on fire. He got a touch of the Steve Marriott's, who we mentioned in the previous podcast, and he died in the fire on his boat. Alan Hull, leader of the great folk rock group Lindisfarne from the Northeast. Very sad. He was only 50, Alan Hull, but what a body of work he left behind. He was a main songwriter, really, for Lindisfarne. And a couple of solo albums as well. Very sad. And Rory Gallagher, the famous blues rock guitarist. A lot of people think he was, you know, the greatest guitarist ever, who were fans of him. But he was only 47. He passed away in 95. And Jerry Garcia, leader of the very aptly named Grateful Dead.
One of the best band names ever.
Yeah, American blues rock band. He passed away. Staying with artists, you'd got Ginger Rogers. We mentioned dance partner Fred Astaire a few podcasts back. She passed away, aged 83. And Dean Martin, Christmas Day, would you believe? Dean Martin, one of the members of the famous Rat Pack of artists, passed away on Christmas Day in 1995. Famous for always having a drink and his songs. What was it? I was trying to think what his famous song was. Little Old Wine Drinker Me, that was one of his songs. He actually did drink a lot of it.
Ain't that a kick in the head?
Ain't that a kick in the head? That's Dean Martin, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's Amore.
Yeah.
Often
that's it, yeah.
By football fans everywhere.
That's right, yeah. Oh, good, well done. Yeah.
Famously, remember the Rat Pack.
That's right,
with,
yeah.
Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. So
that's right.
Kind of that kind of real surge in popularity with the whole idea of swing and having that kind of lounge litter, hard drinking.
Yeah.
Ultra masculine.
As if it was a very virtuous to be half cut all the time. Yeah.
He certainly had a lot of wives.
So a couple of people who reached old ages who passed away was the Kennedy family's matriarch, Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy, passed away in January. She passed away. She was at the ripe old age of 104. So she had what you call a good innings. And she was famously the mother of JFK, John Kennedy, and Bobby Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy, the three sons. Of course, the first two were both assassinated. So, Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy. Another had a great longevity was J. Howard Marshall. I don't know if you've got him up on your screen, James. He reached the age of 90 and wouldn't warrant really much of a mention, except for the fact that he was a billionaire And he married a very young Anne Nicole Smith, who was would be sort of Kardashian type of fame. She was famous for being a bit of a busty blonde who hadn't really done an awful lot except get herself photographed a lot in the papers. And
well, she was a former Playboy bunny.
Yeah, a bit of a paparazzi sort of model. And she got hitched to this 90-year-old billionaire anyway. And of course, he died and he left everything to her. His family weren't too best pleased.
And, so he died in 1995. Yeah. They married in 1994.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a picture of him here in it from his 1926 yearbook. He looks like something out of Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Anna McCall Smith, she obviously famously featured in one of the Naked Gun films.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And died quite tragically herself.
She did, yes, yes. A young age, yeah.
So, yeah, an interesting character that she would be to delve into the kind of psychology there. But yes. I think J. Howard Marshall, it's quite easy to predict what he was thinking at the time.
Yes. I don't know whether he didn't get on very well with his family or what, but I think there was hell on with his sons and his extended family when he bequeathed his fortune to his dear wife.
So his estate became the subject of protracted litigation.
Yes.
Which was reviewed by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, there's a surprise. Yeah.
So, yeah, one not what famous for a very infamous reason.
Yes, yes, sir. And sadly, and another one was Leah Betts, who was just a young girl. She was only 18, and she died after taking ecstasy. Now that drug ecstasy was rife in 1995. It was all over the clubs. And everybody was taking it, apparently, taking great risks because there were some really bad examples of it around, which was badly cut and badly mixed, or you know, come from dodgy sources. And there was deaths through it. And the parents of this young lady, Leah Betts, allowed photographs to be taken of her, which were all over the press, showing her, you know, dying in a hospital bed on life support because of taking this bad ecstasy drug. And it was very brave of them, really, to use as an example, really, of to the youth of the time not to take this dreadful thing, you know.
So on the 16th of November, Leah Betts sadly died.
Yeah.
And within 5 days of being admitted to hospital, apparently she'd taken the MDMA tablet and then drank approximately 7 liters of water, which is potentially lethal on its own doing that.
Yeah, I imagine.
So, you know, there's a lot going on with your body there. But as a result of the taking the tablet, I think that's one of the symptoms is that you become very dehydrated very quickly and need to rehydrate. Yeah. It's interesting because it big part of 90s culture was that kind of, you know, Ebenezer Good ecstasy tablet, drug taking.
Oh, yeah.
The whole Manchester movements based around drugs and rock and roll and all those sorts of things. So apparently Chumbawamba, who you might remember at the time.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
They actually came back with their own anti-poster, apparently, according to this. Of
Really?
You're just as likely to die from eating a bay leaf as from an ecstasy tablet.
Good gracious.
So, I mean, I don't know about the science behind that, but certainly it's a big contrast to the time. You know, you've got this very prominent death, which has resulted in a big anti-drug abuse campaign.
Yeah.
And then you've got this clash with the culture of the time in music and you know, that it's kind of emblematic of the 90s, you know, the smiley faces and things that you used to see.
That's
on the
right. Yeah.
Have a nice day type things you see on the ecstasy tablets.
Yeah. It was rife in 1995, as you say. And, you know, far from being ecstasy, it should have been called anything but that, shouldn't it, really? After, you know, what it did. And as for Chumbawamba, I remember they were the I Get Down and I Get Up Again song, isn't it?
Close enough.
And I remember them, they threw a bucket of water or something over John Prescott, the Labour MP and minister at some awards do, just to get some publicity. Now, lucky he didn't come out with his fists flying like he did once when a fella threw an egg at him. So, Leah Betts, and that was very sad. And just to wrap the demises up, I think you've got Israeli politician Yitzhak Rabin, who was the Prime Minister of Israel. He wasn't at the time, I don't think, Prime Minister, but he was assassinated not by what you'd think from the Arab side or the Palestinian side, but from an ultra-Orthodox Jewish source, because of his peace deal with the Palestinians, which is what a shock. Yeah, he was shot dead.
I mean, we haven't really covered the Israel-Palestine conflict too much in this. No. I'm sure it'll come up in later podcasts. But that is an odd situation, isn't it, to be assassinated for achieving peace.
And I suppose it's one of your own side.
Or attempting to achieve peace at the very least. Yitzhak Rabin and Leah Betz, some very interesting stories there in 1995.
About the music, did we mention in the music the Beatles? The Beatles had unusual.
I've mentioned that.
Yeah, the Beatles had a single out called "Free as a Bird" in 1995, which was very unusual because John Lennon by this stage had been dead for 15 years, and somebody had the bright idea of strolling through the all the outtakes, I think, at Abbey Road in the studios, and they found snippets of John singing on tapes, and they managed to persuade the remaining Beatles, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr, to put something together around these outtakes of John Lennon's, and they came up with "Free as a Bird," which is I'm sad to say, it was an instantly forgettable piece of music. But because it was the Beatles and nobody had heard anything from them for John had been dead 15 years and the Beatles had been split up for 25 years, it obviously entered the charts. An interesting quirk of 1995's music. In July, the 11th of July, we had the Srebrenica massacre. Well, it wasn't the massacre on that date, but that was when the Bosnian Serbs overrun Srebrenica, and it was later on that they'd literally machine gunned 8,000 Muslim men and buried them in mass graves, which is absolutely shocking.
So this is part of something we alluded to last podcast, was this that the part of East Europe. You know, it seems the closer you get to that area of the ex-Soviet Union, you seem to get this instability.
Of course, this was the former Yugoslavia, which was, the breakup of that into its constituent parts, which was to carry on for some time yet. But that was one of the landmark events of that conflict. Of course, NATO peacekeeping troops had been there at this time, and there was a contingent of Dutch UN peacekeepers. UN peacekeepers there, keeping the Serbs at bay. They overran them, and they just brushed the UN Dutch contingent aside, literally, and carried on with their massacre. It resulted in actually the whole of the Dutch government resigned en masse. Shortly after that, because of what happened. Incredible event in itself. Oh, you know what we haven't talked about, James?
What's that?
One of the biggest things of the lot, the Coulham Hall escapades. Yeah, so while that was happening, I was on a course, which was an electrical course for... To learn how to safe isolate electric motors and test motors for damage, and I had to go to Coulham Hall in which was a place in Bromley in Kent, and I was there for a couple of weeks actually, and lots of going out at night and the local pubs and having a drink, and had a couple of games of squash with my pal who went with me, and went for a swim. And we actually one day drove to Dover and caught the hovercraft and went over to Calais for the night, would you believe? and came back, which was great fun. But one event has to be mentioned that that happened there is a proper icebreaker. This is when I'm get conversation going. Have you ever locked yourself out of a room in a hotel naked? Most people would say no, wouldn't they? But that's exactly what happened to me at Cuddam Hall.
Not on this podcast, we cannot say that.
In 1995. We'd had one night in the local pub, local hostelry, and we'd been drinking Old Speckled Hen, I remember the brew was called, the brew of choice, and had had one or two too many. So we managed to stagger home to the Cuddam Hall, and it had this building had three floors. And was on the third floor, long corridor with bedrooms on either side of the corridor, like you get in any hotel. And I remember waking up at about 1:30 in the morning, and I was sleeping in the, it was a hot night, and sleeping at Starkers actually. And I remember throwing the sheet off and getting up. I'd heard a noise, a disturbance, and I wanted to investigate. And
in
I was
the
still,
side,
yeah. So I remember wandering to the door, opening the door, putting my head outside, and then in my stupor, because I was still well oiled with the Old Speckled Hen, I remember stepping outside the door and hearing the horrific noise of the click of the door closing behind me. And there I was in the corridor, third floor, naked as the day I was born, couldn't get back in. So in a blind panic, I could hear a voice down at reception of somebody talking. And there was a young girl on reception, I remember. I thought, oh, God, what am I going to do? There was a plant room opposite my room. A plant room is a place where boilers are and steam pipes and things like that. To my great relief, the door was unlocked. So I went in there, sat on a lagged steam pipe to gather my thoughts. What am I going to do? And in my drunken, scrambled thoughts, I remembered there was a fire escape at the end of the building that led onto the roof. And I knew that my window of my room was open, the sash window. So I opened the door of the plant room, looked up and down, nobody was about. It was 1:30 in the morning, after all. And I ran along the length of this corridor to the fire escape exit at the end, pushed it open, ran up the fire escape, one flight, onto the roof. It was a flat roof. Walked across the gravelly flat roof to where my room was. Clambered over the edge of the roof, and I hung by my hands down, feeling with my tiptoes where my window ledge was. Could just about touch it with my tiptoes. Then I let go with my hands. And as I was falling, I grabbed my sash window with both hands and swung my legs in and propelled myself through the gap, landed on my back in the middle of my bedroom. This was on the third floor. There was a skip. There was a skip filled with rubble immediately below my window. So had I missed grabbing that sash window...
Well, we would have been doing this for a start.
My naked body would have been found the next morning in this skip full of rubble. And I just couldn't believe it. When I sobered up the next morning and I told everybody about it, at breakfast, they all insisted on going up the fire escape and having a look to see where I'd been. Utter disbelief by everybody that I could have done it, you know. I mean, I was 39 then, so I was still pretty fit, you know. I mean, I've had no chance now. I wouldn't have been able to hang on with my fingers over the ledge. I'd have been in the skip and that would be it. But I was quite acrobatic still at that at that age. And I proved it by doing that. Yeah. I think it's a case of having to succeed, you know. Failure was not an option.
Well, that's a very good way of putting a positive spin on what is an absolutely ridiculous story.
I know.
You know. I mean,
apparently it was all crumbly. This edge of this precipice that I'd hung off. You know, it could have just crumbled away in my hands.
You absolutely
lunatic. But you don't realise when you're well out with old speckled hen.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was a campaign broadcast for responsible drinking brought to you by the Half-Life of Brian.
Yeah.
Take heed.
It was totally out of character, I must add, to anybody who's listening.
You're on it.
Never done anything like that before, and I've never done anything like that since.
Miller.
I passed the course as well.
Oh,
would you believe? Yeah. So I got my certificate at the end of it all.
Cheated death.
Yeah.
Got the course.
Yeah. So, yeah, we couldn't miss that out. Yeah. Me. Oh, yeah. O.J. Simpson, I remember that. I mean, he'd actually, the crime had happened the year before, in 94, when this was the trial. He was acquitted, you know, and absolutely incredible, because I remember when it happened, I remember the car chase was televised, you know, where the police chasing after him along the freeway, and they caught him, and he got blood all over him, the blood of the victims, you know, and his blood on his hands, literally. And he killed the body of his wife Nicole and a friend, so it's two murders, were back at the house, and there he was fleeing the scene covered in blood, and he got away with it. Incredible. I think there was a touch of they were worried in case if he was found guilty that it might start race riots again, and there was accusations of them playing the race card, you know, and the defense side of it. But anyway, he got away with it. So that was, you know, what conclusions you draw from that, I don't know. If you've got plenty of money, you can sort of buy the best lawyers and get yourself out of trouble in America, maybe.
Well, it's the pursuit, arrest, and trial of Simpson were among the most widely publicized events in American history, and often characterized as the trial of the century. The jury rendered a verdict of not guilty for the two murders, and an estimated 100 million people nationwide tuned in to watch or listen to the verdict announcement. So you can probably see that there is a kind of, I don't know how much stock you can take in the kind of race angle, but there's certainly going to be a lot of people with a lot of opinions. So according to a poll in 2016, 83% of white Americans and 57% of black Americans believe Simpson committed the murders. So maybe there is some angle you can take there on that. But yeah, what an amazing event, really.
I can remember seeing it when the verdict came over. I remember the camera being on Simpson, and I've seen anybody that look so relieved, you know, when the verdict came over of not guilty. It was very emotive and evocative. It was O.J. Simpson.
Okay, well, I think that about covers 1995. It's another bumper one, Dad. It's been jam packed with war, death, but also our good times, you know, our tragic, the bad news in our family, as well as all the things that typify your typical episode of the Half-Life of Brian.
Lots of little entries about the fish I was buying, because I was running the fish tanks as well then, you know, gouramis and clown loaches and things like that, interspersed between all these events.
That's carrying on. I've got a very fine looking fighting fish going on in the tank right now.
I know you have. Yeah, I've seen them. Beautiful. Yeah. And the zebra Daniels and the loaches.
Yeah. So I'm sure there'll be more fish tank talk. So watch this space if that's your thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've covered gangsters. We've covered murder trials. We've covered war. We've covered films. We've covered TV. We've covered all the different events of 1995, global, critical, trivial, and there's another one I'm forgetting.
Local, global, trivial. That'll do.
But we've covered the entire spectrum here on The Half-Life of Brian.
Even naked drunken acrobatics.
which we have to end on, of course. Yeah, that's a first for this podcast. But there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Right, well, 1996 is coming up next.
Yeah.
And we're heading towards the end of our first sort of de facto season, if you like. Mm-hmm. The penultimate one for the first decade of the diaries. Mm-hmm. Where can you get in touch with the podcast, and you can follow, we're going to put some photos up of like the various autographs as part of meeting the Newcastle players.
Yeah.
There's going to be photographs of the family, as well as little snippets of different facts and figures from different events. So mm-hmm. if you want to follow us on social media, on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, what can they find us on each of those things at that?
At the Half-Life of Bride.
Simple as that. Simple as that. We also have a sister podcast called The Trope Stormers, in which we looked at 1994's Time Cop very recently. So if you're into your film and you like looking at stories and
time travel, how it's
all put together, we've got that for you to listen to as well, at Trope Stormers on the same platforms. And yeah, 1996. Wow.
Yeah.
What a year. We've got the Spice Girls to come. We've got the end of the 90s fast approaching. Mm-hmm. And we're heading ever faster towards the turn of the century and indeed the millennium. So stay here for more updates, more drama, more adventure, more nakedness here on the Half-Life of Brian.
I don't know about that last bit. Yeah.
Well, okay. Also, one last thing. We had in the diary that two things happened right at the end of the year. You went and saw the worst film of all time.
Oh, God. The Power Rangers.
I remember elbowing Dad in the ribs really hard because he was snoring and he was asleep. And
fell asleep in the pictures, yeah.
I think we got our own back as well. So, because Scatman John was also big at the time.
Yeah, that was your... It says in the diary here, that is your the lads have their favourite song at the moment. Scatman. The Scatman, it was called. Is that who it was by? Scatman John?
Yeah. All right. Oh, yeah.
That's right.
The famous was the Be-ba-ba-ba-da-po.
Yeah.
Ba-ba-ba-da-po.
It appealed to lads of your age at the time. Yeah.
So just to annoy you one last time, Dad.
Yeah.
We're going to end the podcast with a Be-ba-ba-da-po. Give us your best.
Be-ba-ba-da-po.
Bebop Badabo, everybody.
Yeah. Earth Song was out as well by Michael Jackson. We didn't mention that. That was a bit more of a placid song.
Well.
Right. Bebop Badabo.
Yeah. What have we done to the world?
What have we done to the world, yeah.
Probably more appropriate.
Yeah.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye. That was good. Good, that's it. Naked, drunken acrobatics.